welcome to the very first Faculty of Life Sciences podcast. I'm Kerry Harrop.
And I'm Greg Council. Every 2 weeks, we'll bring you the very latest news about the life sciences from around the world, making use of the expertise we have here at the University of Manchester to describe some of the most exciting recent biological discoveries. You can download the podcast or subscribe to it by clicking on the podcast link at our website, ls.manchester.ac.uk.
But before we go any further, we're looking for a name for the podcast.
There's a £50 Amazon voucher at stake, so email your suggestions to podcast@manchester.ac.uk.
This week's podcast includes asking you, the listeners, what eyebrows are for, before we get the expert opinion of Professor Jeff Beattie.
In our Spotlight on Manchester slot, Professor Chris Thompson explains how he's been using slime moulds to study stem cells. And we take a look at how the inbuilt clocks in plants might be the key to growing strawberries and asparagus year-round in the UK.
But first up, an exciting breakthrough in the possibility of using modified ecstasy as a treatment for leukemia. Wouldn't it be great if we could stop cancers growing? Researchers at the University of Birmingham have recently discovered that a number of well-known drugs, including the antidepressant Prozac and the drug synonymous with the early 90s rave culture, ecstasy, can halt the growth of cancer cells, specifically in leukemia. Excellent news! So if we legalise and market ecstasy as an anti-cancer drug, job done, right? Wrong. Ecstasy is used as a recreational drug because it makes people more alert and in tune with their surroundings. This gives them a euphoric high. But these feelings come at a price, not least the risk of major long-term anxiety, panic attacks, severe dehydration, liver, kidney and heart problems, and even death. Such side effects are clearly unwanted in an anti-cancer drug. Furthermore, the dose of ecstasy that was required to kill the cancer cells was so high that it would prove fatal if given to people. By some clever chemical manipulation, scientists at the University of Birmingham have created a variant of ecstasy that is 100-fold more potent at killing cancer cells in the blood than the original form, meaning that a 100 times lower dose is required to be effective, thereby reducing the unwanted psychological and neurological side effects. Now we speak to Professor Alan Dixon from the Centre of Excellence in Biopharmaceuticals, based here in the Faculty of Life Sciences.
I think this is very much a case of many of the drugs. We don't fully understand what they all do. Many of them have defined actions because they've been screened on that basis. As we start to look sideways, we begin to see that they have other unexpected activities that might be incredibly beneficial.
So what makes this modified form of ecstasy such an exciting candidate as an anti-cancer drug? The drug is attracted to the fatty membranes of the cancerous cells, breaking down this membrane in much the same way as washing up liquid cuts through grease and grime on dirty dishes. This damages the cancer cells, breaking down their cell membrane and finally killing them. The great news is that cancer cells are much more susceptible to this breakdown than normal healthy cells, which may mean the drug could act with minimal side effects.
The ability to treat leukemia with a well-known drug just by a slight chemical modification opens brand new doors for us. But with any drug development process, you know, you've got to be very, very careful. It takes a long time to go from initial heads-up story to the reality. I think one of the things we shouldn't be telling people to do is go out and start dosing themselves up with ecstasy. There's a long way to go there to a clinical trial.
This week, I've been speaking to life science students from the University of Manchester and getting their thoughts on why we have eyebrows. Here's what a few of you had to say.
Why do we have eyebrows, did you say? Because to stop the sweat going into your eyes.
Disagree.
And
I'm going to say it's because we're a social species and I think it helps people...
Isn't it to stop the sweat from running into our eyes? When we sweat on our forehead, then it doesn't run into our eyes.
I think we've got eyebrows to frame our eyes and to help human interaction.
Because it's to stop little bits of dropping in your face.
to stop sweat dripping into your eyes.
They're ways of expressing yourself, aren't they?
To register human emotion. Surprise.
They are the curtains to the soul.
Jeff Beattie is a professor of psychology here at the University of Manchester with many award-winning books and articles. He's also a well-known face through his work on television, including 10 series of Big Brother. Jeff studies how psychology can shed light on human behaviour, so who better to explain why we have eyebrows?
Well, I don't think the main function is keeping rain out of the eyes. I don't know if they're very effective at that. Eyebrows are a very visual signal, and they're absolutely core to the way human beings express their emotional state to another human being. And if you think about things like anger and fear, they're only distinguished really by the position of the eyebrows. So when people are angry, their eyes are wide, but their eyebrows are in repose. When people are frightened, their eyes are wide and their eyebrows go up. And it's really important for human beings to distinguish whether someone's frightened or angry, evolutionarily speaking. Just think of the importance of that. So the eyebrows are absolutely crucial to that. But they have other functions as well as emotions. I mean, human beings like to position themselves within the social group. That's absolutely core to how we evolved. And eyebrows are a great appeasement signal. So if you want to appear submissive, you raise your eyebrows. And of course, that's why women pluck their eyebrows. So they arch the eyebrows, and that makes them look in a permanent submissive state. Now, it's interesting that men find that attractive. I wonder why that is. And the third main function of eyebrows, of course, is facial identification. If you want to recognise someone, the eyebrows are crucial. Shave the eyebrows off, and of course psychologists have done that. It takes a lot more effort to work out who they are. So eyebrows are one of those funny little things that you think, in Darwinian terms, is it just the remaining vestige of hair on the face? Well, not really. They've played a crucial role in the development of social groups, in the expression of emotion, and in telling other human beings and the group members in which we grew up who we are, so they could identify us. So eyebrows are pretty important.
Purely for aesthetic reasons.
Yeah? Oh yeah, actually, I take my answer back. We'd all look absolutely minging without them.
Exactly.
Stem cells are extremely important in modern medicine, as they can be transformed into any kind of cell and used in various therapies. However, we really don't know how to control their development and make them turn into a particular kind of cell. Professor Chris Thompson of the Faculty of Life Sciences here at the University of Manchester is trying to find out how we can control stem cell development in a major new study funded by the Wellcome Trust. To discover the answer, Chris will be using slime moulds. Slime moulds are single-celled organisms that, for most of the time, act as individual cells. However, when their very survival is at stake, they grow together and produce a kind of fruit. Some cells become stalk on the fruit and others turn into spores, and by cooperating in this fashion, the cells that have become spores can travel in the wind and make new colonies. This remarkable mechanism is due to cell-to-cell communication, with each cell knowing exactly what to become and thereby cooperating to ensure the slime mould's survival. So what does this have to do with stem cells, and how can slime moulds give us the answer to the holy grail of scientific research, controlling stem cell fate? We caught up with Professor Chris Thompson to find out more. Chris, welcome to the FLS podcast. Now tell me, it's already been identified by researchers which chemical signals tell a stem cell to become, for instance, a nerve cell, a bone cell. So why can't we use these chemicals to control stem cells?
Well, the answer is that in theory we can. We know quite a lot of the signals that can control stem cells to turn into whatever, pretty much whatever we like. The major problem is that when we add those signals to the cells, they don't actually do what we want, and only a small percentage of the cells actually respond in the way that we would predict to do so.
So in terms of a treatment then, the efficiency there would be very, very low if we're looking at it as a kind of long term. So we're taking a huge step back and using slime molds just to do this. How does that work?
The great thing about slime molds is that they're just not as complex as a human, which is really, of course, what we really want to understand. But the reason that we're able to use a slime mold to do this is because they're simple, they grow in the lab very, very easily, we can manipulate them genetically in ways that we just couldn't feasibly do on human cells. But of course, that's nothing on its own, but the major driving force behind us being able to do this is because slime molds actually behave in exactly the same way as stem cells do.
So this is a great model and potentially brilliantly cost effective and great for use in the lab. And one thing that we mentioned to our listeners earlier was this concept of this stalk and spore formation that these slime molds have and how that helps their survival. But what is the benefit to the stalk formers, unless I've misunderstood?
Think about it as in terms of some of the cells will sacrifice themselves for the greater good, because if none of the cells actually made the stalk, then you'd end up with a pretty weird looking fruiting body which only had spores and no stalk. You have to assume that the stalk has some sort of value, some sort of use probably to hold the spores and help them be dispersed. The question, of course, is why doesn't evolution drive individuals to not be the ones that make the stalk? And that's, of course, a major question, and really one in which we were trying to understand at the moment. Why doesn't evolution always follow the trajectory that we would predict?
So the ultimate question then, how do you hope that you're going to use these slime moulds and what you've learnt about them to actually understand the control of stem cell fate?
Slime moulds behave in exactly the same way as stem cells do, in that we know that a slime mould cells will respond to a signal to drive cells to become a stalk cell, but when we give them this signal, only a small number of the cells actually respond. It's the same as the stem cells do, that only a small number respond. So what we're trying to do is to understand why it is that only a small number of cells do respond to the signal, to understand the priming mechanism behind cellular responses to signals.
Brilliant, thank you, that's fascinating. Well, best of luck with your study. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Every time we go into a supermarket, we see strawberries, even though they are only in season in the early summer. For the rest of the year, they're imported, with all the expense and the massive carbon footprint that implies.
Farmers can only grow what is in season. Strawberries won't fruit in December, even if you grow them inside. This is because they know what time of year it is, whatever the light and temperature conditions. Plants, like animals, have inbuilt biological clocks that tell them what time of day and even what time of year it is. What if we could fiddle with that clock and convince plants that it is a different time of year? Researchers at Yale University in the United States have identified a key genetic cog in the plant clock that helps plants know what time of year it is.
The biological clock is an internal timekeeper that helps to synchronize biological processes with the day and the night, and even over longer periods of time. In plants, these are particularly important to allow growth to adjust according to the hours, the days, and the seasons. And these clocks are known as circadian clocks because they go through more or less a daily cycle, so from the Latin circa diem, around a day.
The clock has two main parts, each encoded by different genes, morning genes and evening genes. Proteins encoded by the morning genes suppress evening genes at daybreak, but by nightfall, levels of these proteins drop and evening genes are activated. These evening genes are necessary to turn on morning genes and thereby complete a 24-hour cycle.
The Yale scientists solved one of the last remaining mysteries in this process when they identified a particular gene, DET1, as being crucial in suppressing expression of the evening genes in the plant's circadian cycle.
The lead author, Onsun Lau, said, "Plants that make less DET1 have a faster clock and they take less time to flower. Knowing the components of the plant's circadian clock and their roles would assist in the selection or generation of valuable traits in crop and ornamental plants."
For the first time, this raises the real possibility of growing crops year-round and may have major implications for global agriculture. There's a chance we could be growing strawberries in our back gardens all year round. Well, that's all for this week, but before we go, let me remind you once again to send your suggestions for naming the podcast to podcast@manchester.ac.uk, and the chosen name will win £50 Amazon vouchers. Also, if you have any other questions or comments, you can contact us there. That's podcast@manchester.ac.uk. And join us next time for more news and views from the world of life sciences.
The podcast is written, presented, and produced by Kerry Harrop and Greg Council, and is edited by Matthew Cobb.